From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman Jim Costa, a Democrat from the state of California, and we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. Congressman Costa has been serving constituents in the central San Joaquin Valley since 2005. Raised on a dairy farm in Fresno, Congressman Costa is a third-generation family farmer. Not coincidentally, he is a member of the House of Representatives Agriculture and Natural Resources Committees. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Congressman Costa about a range of domestic and international issues facing the United States. We'll get his take on the repercussions of the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, the cancellation of the U.S.-North Korea summit, and the collapse of the Farm Bill. We'll also look forward to congressional midterm elections, where analysts say Democrats, the minority party, are slated to pick up a significant number of seats in the House of Representatives. Congressman Jim Costa, welcome to the program.
Well, Carol, thank you. It's my honor to be on Voice of America. For years, I have followed the efforts that Voice of America has tirelessly pursued, and I think it is a great platform for America to try to make people aware around the world of what our better instincts and values are all about as a country. Through the Cold War and through the détente and then through the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Voice of America has always been there. And as I interact as the vice chair of the Transatlantic Legislators Dialogue and the co-chair of the Transatlantic Policy Network, I've had for 12 years a lot of interaction with our colleagues in Europe and watched the European Union grow and develop post-Lisbon Treaty. And now as a participant in the NATO Assembly, you know, you have former Eastern European countries that were part of the Soviet bloc that are now part of the European Union. And they talk about Voice of America, and they talk about the role that Voice of America played during the Cold War and after. So this is my first time on Voice of America, and I'm honored to be on it.
Well, we're honored to have you, and thank you for that. I met you, actually, on EU Day, Europe Day,
right.
And so that was a privilege for me. And I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about your district in California, Fresno, why you decided to run for office some 13 years ago, and what issues are most important to your district.
Well, the 16th Congressional District in California is in the center of the state. People, especially in Europe, but anywhere around the world, hear about California. There's always, you know, a lot of interest because California has around the world had a reputation for being a trending state, both good trends, positive trends, and some trends that maybe aren't so positive. Nonetheless, because of Hollywood, because of the development post-World War II and Silicon Valley and high tech, and what a lot of people are not aware of, but California has been the number one agricultural state in the nation for over 50 years. And my family are farmers. The idea of America is immigrants past and immigrants present. And I think when you look at the richness, the mosaic that makes up our country, it's really a reflection of people from all around the world. And certainly my family reflects that, coming from the Azores Islands off the coast of Portugal, my grandparents in 1897 and 1904, not speaking English, and three of the four of them illiterate all of their lives, but yet with this hope and dream that coming to America, they could have a better life for themselves and their families. So in Fresno, California, it's really kind of the center of the agricultural region of California. Last year, $48 billion at the farm gate with over 300 commodities that we grow. And a lot of people don't realize we grow half the nation's fruits and vegetables, number one in dairy, number one in citrus production, 70% of the world's almonds. That's what I grow almonds. But it used to be a typical Portuguese dairy farm that my grandfather with my dad and my uncle developed. My cousin farms table grapes and walnuts and prunes, and my other cousin, Janelle, farms currants and walnuts. And my sister and I farm almonds, or as we say back on the farm, almonds. So it's growing up on this Portuguese dairy farm that gave and instilled values with me. My father had to quit school in the sixth grade, and my mother as a freshman in high school to work. I think that's been the reflection of people who have come from all over the world to America, that strong work ethic and family values. And so that's how I was brought up. But one of the things that I think most of the ethnic communities feel that if you do well, that you're supposed to give something back. And that's how I was brought up. And you should be involved for democracy to work. And we're in the world's oldest democracy. And so my parents thought it was important that they get involved and that they participate locally. And I grew up with that. And so my mother urged me between my junior and senior year at Fresno State University to take an internship in Washington. And that summer of 73 was kind of a turning point, because being a student of American history and world history, I, you know, knew what I had learned. But when you come to Washington, you also learn that it's not like it's in the textbook. But I really came away with wanting to get more involved and participate. So at 25, I ran for the state legislature, got elected, served in California. But today, the fifth largest economy in the world, if California were a nation state, and became the chairman of the Democratic Caucus in California, and then retired because of term limits at the tender young age of 49, and was farming and doing some consulting work, and then an opportunity came to run for Congress. 14 years ago, I did that and was elected, and now I'm in my 14th year.
Congressman Costa, you bring up so many important points that we want to explore: the importance of the agriculture sector here in America, particularly in California, our farmers, as well as the importance of immigrants, that we are a nation of immigrants. So we're going to get into those. But first, I'd like you to discuss the significance and the purpose of this multi-year farm bill that came to a vote recently, but which failed. Give us a sense, educate our audience about the significance of this bill. What are the implications for low-income families, for example, and for American farmers and the agricultural industry here in America?
Well, the reauthorization of the farm bill in Congress is something that happens every 4 or 5 years, and it's just as important as the Agricultural Act is in the European Union. And so the Agricultural Act in Washington establishes our priorities, not only for the various farming that takes place regionally throughout the country, but it also involves our safety net for our nutrition programs, for those who are at the lower rung of the economic ladder. That's where our food stamps program, otherwise known as SNAP, takes place, for children, for elderly, for disabled, and for what we call able-bodied adults, but who are working at minimum wage jobs or jobs that are not sufficient to support themselves. And it also includes our nutrition programs for our schools, both our school lunch and our school breakfast programs. So half the bill, roughly, is split on agricultural commodity programs for efforts like dairy and sugar and other farm support programs, specialty crops, and efforts to provide, as an example, market access to compete with other products around the world that we export. And what has always traditionally been a very bipartisan bill, going back to the 60s, has gone off the tracks, as we say. And a bill was voted out of committee on a strictly partisan basis, which saddened me, and was attempted to be brought up on the floor last week on a partisan basis, and it failed. You know, the Democrats made, and I'm one of the leaders in the committee, numerous efforts to try to bridge the gap over the nutrition programs where the initial opposition developed. The issue really centered on work programs, and I believe that able-bodied people should be working. I think work is an important value. To cut to the chase, as we say, the Senate is working under what has been the normal practice, and they're working on a bipartisan farm bill that will take 60 votes in the Senate. And I think before our recess in August, they will vote out a Senate bill. I think ultimately this is going to come together.
Congressman Costa, in addition to wanting to raise work requirements and perhaps even cut some of the subsidies, food stamp subsidies, on the part of the more conservative members of the Agricultural Committee that helped to kill this bill. We understand also that it failed because there was an immigration component.
Correct.
That some hard-line, mostly Republican members of the so-called Freedom Caucus or so-called Tea Partiers wanted to introduce some immigration legislation in exchange for voting on this bill. So let's look at immigration writ large and with respect to the so-called Dreamers in particular. Mr. Trump has expressed himself on immigration. He wants to even limit legal immigration in addition to curbing undocumented workers. He wants to build the wall, we know, etc. Then there's also the question of the Dreamers. What is your position with respect to these so-called Dreamers? We're referring to children who were brought here illegally by their parents, some over 800,000 immigrants. What is your position with respect to how to deal with the so-called Dreamers? And do you think something can be passed in a bipartisan way?
Well, I hope so, and we're working on that. And there's multiple factions in the Republican conference on most any issue, like there are in the Democratic caucus, but certainly on the immigration issue. And there's another group that we are working with, Democrats, to bring the DREAM Act to the floor to vote on it. And now over 20 members of the Republican conference have signed a discharge petition, and over 100 members of the Democratic caucus have signed the same discharge position. And my position has been very clear. I've met with many of the Dreamers in my district. Probably I have over 5,000, and they're in my universities, they're in secondary schools. And these individuals came here at an average age from 2 to 6 years of age. For them, America is their country. They don't know the country that they came from, and their entire reference is as being an American. Let's be clear, have a broken immigration system in America, and this existed for over a decade. In 2013, we came very close to a comprehensive immigration, a bipartisan bill that passed the Senate 68 to 32. Doesn't get more bipartisan than that. And there were certainly, I believe, 180 or more Democrats that would have voted for it, and probably 60 or more Republicans that would have passed if Speaker Boehner had allowed it to come to the floor. Unfortunately, because of the politics in the Republican conference, he was unwilling to do so. And we have that same dynamic occurring now. And so you had some of these freedom-loving people in their sort of Tea Party caucus that want to carry the president's bidding in building a wall. Calls it chain migration, which is nothing more than family reunification. It's a hurtful term, frankly. And so what we know is that the president repealed Obama's executive order to allow Dreamers to stay here. And he did it for political reasons last September. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this discussion because he wanted to leverage it to build a wall. This wall is a political symbol for him. That, by the way, and I excuse my humor, I thought Mexico was going to pay for that wall. Of course they're not going to pay for that wall. But this is a part of the president's politics when he engages in racial overtones that are divisive in our country. And he continues to do that. And so some of those in the Freedom Caucus thought this would be an opportunity to bring this good lot bill to the floor, leveraging it with the farm bill. And of course, the other faction, another more moderate faction in the Republican conference, saw, well, this is an opportunity to try to work with the Democrats to bring the DREAM Act to the floor. So all of these have converged, and it's not very pretty. It's messy. And what happens here in the next few weeks remains to be seen, whether or not these moderate Republicans working with Democrats will successfully be able to bring the DREAM Act to the floor or not. And whether or not the conservative Freedom Caucus will be able to pressure the Republican leadership into bringing this conservative good lot bill to the floor. And it's all gotten tangled up in the farm bill, which has nothing to do with it, except, let me say, in my area, 70% of our workforce in agriculture is undocumented. So 80% of my farmers are Republicans and support the president. But on two important issues for agriculture in California and elsewhere, that being labor where immigration is a key because so much of the workforce is undocumented, and trade, which is critical because we produce more products than we can consume. The president's actions on immigration and on trade run counter to the interests of California agriculture.
Very interesting. We'll talk more about trade and other related issues in just a moment. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. We're talking with Congressman Jim Costa. He's a Democrat from the state of California. Congressman Costa serves on the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committees. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Nawab Behdad. He's a loyal listener and Facebook fan from Kabul, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com and like us or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to our special guest, Congressman Jim Costa, a Democrat from the state of California. Congressman Costa, I'd like now to turn to a couple of international issues. We just learned last week that President Trump canceled the summit between him and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. It was supposed to be taking place in Singapore in June. It is on hold now. I wanted to get your take on these talks, if and when they do transpire. How do you see this type of negotiation? Do you see it as premature, particularly as the United States pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal? Are you optimistic that something can be achieved, or do you think we have to go back to the drawing board, given their track record, that is, the track record of North Korea? And there are differences on the definition of denuclearization.
Absolutely. Whatever differences that I may have with our president, I wish him every success in dealing with the denuclearization of North Korea and the Korean Peninsula. It's in the best interest of not only the United States, but our allies in Japan and South Korea and in Asia and around the world, frankly. So when we look at the current status with our withdrawing from the summit, I think it's a combination of factors that are in play and how much of this is President Trump's view of the world, the art of making the deal, that you got to make demands that are higher than expectations will allow so you can negotiate downward, that you should always attempt to seem unstable and erratic, which I thought was the North Korean dictator's role, but obviously our president has replicated some of that over the last 6 months. And the third point of his art of making the deal is don't seem like you want it too much and be prepared to walk away from it. I guess that's what he's done, although prior he seemed like he wanted it very much. And I think he was informed by a number of his advisors that given the North Korean dictator leverage, and then his security advisor and the vice president suggested that the Libyan model was what they were seeking in an agreement with North Korea. Well, if I'm the dictator of North Korea, we all know what the effect of Gaddafi was. And of course, the president's confusion in talking about what occurred in 2002 and then the ultimate results in 2011 when the dictatorship fell in Libya obviously was a case of not getting the facts straight. But certainly, I don't think it helped build our case. Normally, these kinds of diplomatic negotiations take a lot of work and a lot of time and preliminary efforts with meetings taking place at the lower levels to create the building blocks to develop a successful summit. And the president's quick response 6 weeks ago to say, yes, I'll sit down and meet with Kim Jong-un, I think automatically gave the North Korean dictator a victory of sorts, because no American president up until this time has been willing to even consider meeting with the North Korean dictator. So you couple that with our withdrawal from the Iranian agreement. If I'm the North Koreans, and I've had a lot of conversations with my European counterparts on this, our allies, the British and the French and others in Europe, and they are wondering just what is America thinking? If I'm the North Korean leadership and I look at what the United States did with its agreement with Iran and walked away from it, that's going to lead me to think, what should I believe and how can I trust America to keep any agreement that they make with us.
Now, National Security Advisor John Bolton has a different reading. He says, well, the message they will probably take is that we do not engage in bad deals. In other words, his definition of the Iran nuclear deal was that it was not a good deal and that the interpretation that the North Koreans would take from the U.S. withdrawal would be, see, they don't accept bad deals. Again, just giving the other side point of view. And that leads me to the withdrawal of the Iran nuclear deal. I met you on European Union Day just a day or so after Mr. Trump withdrew the United States from the Iran nuclear deal. And with respect to that, there are so many implications. You know, there are those who say that the United States negotiators and some European Union negotiators were on the cusp of coming up with a side deal that could address ballistic missile proliferation, as well as other concerns of Iran's nefarious actions within the region. And then Mr. Trump decides to, before they can really nail down a convergence, withdraws from the deal. So that, in many critics' eyes, was very unfortunate. I'd like to get your take on the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal. What impact will it have with respect to Iran? Could it encourage them to resume uranium enrichment? Could it actually have the opposite effect of encouraging them to engage in more terrorist activities in the region? And what about, Congressman Costa, the implications on our NATO and transatlantic allies? Because we're hearing from the administration that if they want to stay in the deal and continue to do business with Iran, that the United States would sanction their businesses. And some critics are saying that that could really split the transatlantic alliance, which is very important as a bulwark against nefarious actors like Russia, China, and Iran.
Well, let me say that as a member of the conference committee in 2010 that put the sanctions on Iran, I've been involved in this for a number of years, as well as being a member of the NATO assembly. And I think that the NATO pact that we've had has been an incredible bulwark protecting both European and U.S. securities over decades. And the unilateral withdrawal of the United States on the Iranian agreement, I see occurring the law of unintended consequences that I don't believe this president has thought of. And certainly Secretary Mattis and others in the administration argued against withdrawing from the agreement. But like this matter, the withdrawal by the president and the Paris Climate Accord and other factors, I can't help but feel that much of what the president does in these cases are motivated by his political agenda and comments he made or promises he believed he made during the campaign that were not well thought out. And I think this is a good example of that. He had said that this was the worst deal ever. Well, it wasn't. This deal was specifically crafted for one purpose, and that was providing a time period, in this case 15 years, for Iran not to have a nuclear bomb. The missiles are an important issue. There are other related issues in terms of Iran's conduct, supporting terrorist groups, Hamas and others throughout the world, that are all valid issues. However, they were never intended to be a part of the agreement. So to somehow cast all these other issues as a part of the agreement and then describe it as the worst ever is just incorrect, it's unfair, and it's wrong. As a result of this, now we're having to deal with these unintended consequences, because our European allies were very close to dealing with some of the other issues that, like the missile testing, that could have improved the agreement. But instead of allowing the president to work as he should be with our valued allies in Europe, and after repeated conversations by President Macron and Chancellor Merkel and Prime Minister May, he ignored all of it because he had this domestic, agenda that fit with his politics.
In the very few minutes we have left, Congressman Costa, with respect to trade policy, particularly the tariffs on imported steel and aluminum that President Trump has imposed, saying for national security reasons, some critics are wondering, you know, how that is substantiated. So we have those tariffs. We have now tariffs on some products from China, over $150 billion, now on hold, given some talks that are taking place. But back to the fundamentals, what is your position on imposing tariffs on imported goods? Does that help or hurt in the long run American farmers and manufacturers?
It hurts and it's counterproductive. The way to deal in a global market that we live in today is to reach agreements. And these agreements, because of the nature of global trade, are multilateral. The president's in this mindset that everything can be bilateral, that somehow, as he tries to define it, and it makes for good politics at home, let's be clear about that in some sectors, that, you know, we don't win trade agreements anymore, and that somehow there's this definition that we should win and they should lose. No country in the world is going to negotiate with America if somehow the U.S. wins and say, okay, America, you win and we lose. That's a non-starter. It makes no sense. It's not logical. As opposed to understanding the complexity of these negotiations and the agreements, and you have to create win-win situations because it's the only way you're successfully going to reach an agreement. Europe and the United States together constitute almost half the world's trade. That will change over the 21st century. We have an opportunity under the World Trade Organization and other negotiations that are taking place with regards to trade, working together to create a more fair and balanced system around the world and rules that other countries must comply with, whether we're talking about China, which has been a bad actor, to be sure, but simply trying to implement tariffs on China that really have little harm to China but impact our friends in Europe makes no sense. And trying to pick winners and losers really, again, ignores the difficult, complex nature of how we trade between Europe and the United States and around the world.
Well, as we close quickly, midterms coming up in November, analysts are saying that, you know, there may be a blue wave, that is, more Democrats are likely to win seats, maybe take the majority in the House of Representatives. That would allow for greater leverage over what comes to the floor, hearings, etc. How optimistic are you as a Democrat, and I assume you're going to run again, for this outcome? And what would your priorities be if the Democrats were able to be in the majority in the House of Representatives?
Well, I am running for re-election, and we hope that goes well. And unlike some, I don't think there's any certainty that we are going to regain the majority. But if we did, it would certainly offer a greater opportunity of checks and balances. In the United States, we have three separate branches of government, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judiciary. And our founding fathers developed that so that there would be these checks and balances. But many of my colleagues on the Republican side don't seem to have any interest of providing any checks with this administration in terms of the hearing process, in terms of transparency, in terms of bipartisan cooperation. So whether or not we regain the majority remains to be seen. The matchups between Republicans and Democrats in the general election in the fall are in part determined by the primary elections. And so we still have a lot of primaries to take place. The last are in August in Florida. And so how well we have matchups between our Democratic nominees and our Republican nominees, our incumbents, will determine whether or not we ultimately can win in November. And a lot can happen between now and then, as we all know, whether it's in the Korean Peninsula or in Iran or elsewhere in the world, that will have maybe some bearing or impact on American elections. But let me just say that in terms of what we could do if we had a Democratic majority in the House, I think that there would be a greater emphasis to fix this broken immigration system in a bipartisan fashion. I think there would be greater opportunities to come together with a infrastructure bill to repair America's bridges, roads, highways, our transportation systems, and our waterways. In addition to that, I think that we would find an opportunity to ensure that we seek the truth and the facts, and we not get in this narrative where we have alternative facts and where we're constantly beating up the most important institutions of our government, our judiciary, our intelligence agencies, and our freedom of press that are, I think, the cornerstones of American democracy. Men and women that are working on behalf of our FBI, our CIA, our Justice Department are patriots, and they are, in many instances, risking their lives to protect our American democracy, and that attacking them for political purposes is not the American way.
Congressman Jim Costa is a Democrat from the state of California. Congressman Costa, thank you so much for taking time.
Thank you. It's my honor to be on Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer and producer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. of America.